Hello, Husky fans, and welcome to another episode of the Fast Break Podcast. I am not Amon Kidwai, who's taking a little break today. I'm Dan Madigan, but I'm joined with Patrick Martin, and we're here after UConn's 77-52 win over Illinois in the Elite Eight to advance to the second straight Final Four for the Huskies. UConn won 77-52 and shut down star Terrence Shannon Jr., who had 8 points, a season low, and was really unable to get anything going all night. The win gives UConn 35 for the season, which breaks the previous mark of 34 set in 1998 and 1999 under Jim Calhoun, UConn's first national championship. Patrick, you were there. We had boots on the ground as esteemed media. What were your thoughts from the game?
I mean, how long can I go here? How much you? I'm calling for the ball, and I'm not giving it back. I'm just going to take 1,000 dribbles here and pound the post.
Look. You're clinging in the post. Go ahead and cook, man.
I am exactly like Kling Kong. Where to begin? Terrence Shannon Jr., 2 of 12, didn't hit a three. It was, I think we need to start in the beginning. Amon and I were not expecting our credentials to be courtside because Amon was covering in the rafters before. Or not in the rafters, but like up in the bleachers. So I got there early and you know, was expecting that. As in a side note, my dad bought a YOLO ticket the morning of. So he rode up with me in true just grip it and rip it fashion. So we rode up there, got a hotel last minute, just completely fly by the pants of your seat style. But we get there and it's like, oh my God, Amon, we're courtside today. I don't know what happened from Thursday to Saturday, but we get there courtside and you get to see so much. And I don't know how to really unpack it all. I guess we can kind of like go based off of whatever. I just had random like thoughts and notes that we can dive into, but the way they are feeding Donovan Clingan inside early is it's even more of an emphasis live. Hurley is calling out when he wants the ball in the post. Like he is actually timing when he wants it dumped in. He'll literally say, now. Like, you remember that Jim Calhoun viral, hit him, you MFer. That's what he's doing, feeding the ball into Clingan inside. A lot of other kind of tidbits I see, like he did not want the pace pushed at first in that really tight first half. It almost seemed like he wanted to win the possession battle via a slowed down pace. I thought that was interesting because then in the second half, when they're on this insane 30-0 run that we'll get into, he was pushing. He's go. So he has all these different levers to push that I thought was insane. Not a fan of booty ball. Also, I'm just kind of like going off the cuff here. That's push off ball. I mean, Marcus Damask is a very, very good player, but Hurley was riding the officials nonstop about the push offs. And I think there was some merit to that. It's an interesting strategy for basketball, but it's you really have to have the certain type. And UConn seemed to be it was a smart move for Hurley to switch Caravan on him, because while Caravan doesn't have the foot speed, but he has the size to combat Damask. And I thought that was interesting. Another thing that you notice when you're right there, like I could stick my hand out and poke Dan Hurley in the back. The whole staff gets into it. It is a top down effect with that team, to the point that it's not even Hurley that's the psychopath anymore. And here's kind of the hot take: he is in total control of his environment. When he's losing his mind, that's a controlled decision. That's a lever that he's pushing. In the moment, he's not out of control ever. And in fact, the more emphatic one from start to finish is Luke Murray. Luke Murray is doing two small signs when Donovan Clingan is doing reverses and backing down Coleman Hawkins. But it's the managers, it's the bench players. They're not showboating. They're not gesturing to the crowd. It's not individual stuff. It's all in internally focused, or they're pumping each other up, and it's channeled in such a positive way that you can't help but just get excited. And then that translates over to the fans directly behind that are like the friends and the family. And so you can just see it spreading. And then you got the partiers from the top, you know, from the bleachers coming in. It was the loudest game I have ever been a part of. And that's saying something, because the second half with 10 minutes to go, it was analytically final. So I mean, couple other points that stand out: Caravan hanging off the rim. I was able to get a video of that, and you can just, there are so many little things to unpack. You got Luke Murray just doing a Kevin Garnett scream, Steph Castle just this nonstop, even Bob Hurley just like fist pounding. This is an absurd, like there is so much to take out of these moments. That like you really like, I encourage people to rewatch the games at this point, relive this as much as you can, because there is so much to grab out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like just personally, I was watching on a TV like a lot of folks here, and it just seemed like the ball movement was at a whole nother level for the entire game. And I think some of that is because the Illinois defense was truly awful, and it was worse than I even anticipated. I thought Illinois looked pretty good in that game against Iowa State. I thought the defense may have kind of made a turn. It probably was just a good personnel matchup, because they were quite awful on defense. I think they're 90 something in KenPom, and it looked every bit of that. But I was curious what your thoughts were, because I feel like you can look at this game from two different lenses, right? I kind of think that UConn's offense was just dominant. Like, Illinois had no answer. 1.12 points per possession, scoring at will. From multiple guys. They had five guys in double figures, clinging at 22 points. But you could also go the other way and very easily say that the defense just suffocated Illinois from the start. And for me, there was a possession, I think the first two possessions, Klingon scored down low. And then the next possession for Illinois, Shannon went down. Castle bottled him up, deflected the ball. Wasn't a block necessarily, but he had no control going to the hoop. And that's when I kind of looked at it and I said, hold up. I think there's something here. Like, I think everyone was talking about Castle versus Shannon. We saw it. We were seeing it in real time. That it was like, holy cow, like Steph Castle can hang with Terrence Shannon, and he's kind of holding his own right now. And he did that throughout the course of the game. And we can't talk about the defense without talking about Donovan Klingon, right? Illinois scored 14 points total while he was on the floor. Klingon played 22 minutes. They scored 14 points in half of the game. He was just a total force on both ends. He's been doing this all tournament. The San Diego State game, which we didn't talk a whole lot about because, quite honestly, it was more of a snoozer than this Illinois game. That was probably his worst game against San Diego State, but I thought he did a decent job trying to stay out of foul trouble against Jaden Ledee, and it was a really tough matchup for him. But he's just been the breakout star of this NCAA tournament, and I feel like we talked about UConn having Cam Spencer, having Tristan Newton, having Steph Castle. We knew Donovan Klingon was good, but I feel like he's taking his game to an entirely different level. And so that's what kind of makes me lean that the defense kind of won this game for UConn, and the offense was just awesome as usual.
It was 100% the defense. 100% the defense. He had three, I think, straight up contests at the rim. And I don't even know if they were counted as blocks, because I don't think the ball left like Illinois' attacker's hands. And to do those without fouling, most people know ball, that like that's a huge moment. That's like, oh, yes. And then when you get the ball and you're on the break and you have Alex Caravan, who has the IQ to leak out after a play like that, and you get easy buckets, those are huge swings, you know, 4-point swings, 5-point swings that start with the defense. So it is 100% on Donovan Klingon for that. I've never seen someone straight up contest like that without fouling, and they're not fouls. You can talk to the most you can bring Ant Wright, you know, the Big Ten slurper, on here, and he'd say, yeah, no, those weren't fouls. In fact, I think he even tweeted that. I like was trying to, you know, start some shit after the game, and like was like, all right, what are these idiots saying? And no, they're like, yeah, no, he's really freaking good. And I love, you know, after Illinois beat Iowa State, there was like, oh, like, you know, it's they're not nothing we haven't seen in the Big Ten. He said, oh, we're going to keep going at Donovan Klingon. You know, if he gets 100, you know, 100 blocks, good for him or whatever. I haven't seen much of UConn. Whew, that is the classic fuck around and find out. I saw someone great on Twitter compared it to like some comedian sketch that's like the NRA people that think that they can take on like the military. It's like, well, we have drones. You can just do that. It's like, well, we have Donovan Klingon when we just drop in the middle and completely erase the paint. It was such a detonation defensively. It worried me that we'll talk about Alabama later, that now no sane coach is going to try to say, oh, well, we have rim attackers, we can try to win at the rim. Because I, as much as we can clown Underwood for that strategy, you do look at Terrence Shannon Jr. and at Damascus' ability to get inside and Coleman Hawkins's inside out ability and say, okay, we can make life difficult for Donovan Klingon. Maybe they can make life difficult for January and February Donovan Klingon, but this is the dude that a lot of fans thought we were going to get from day one, his sophomore year, like the 20-10, 5 line with all these plays and, you know, staying out of foul trouble, being so mobile. The story is true that he affects shots even that he's not even near. And the point about Terrence Shannon and Steph Castle, I think, is interesting because Steph Castle is, and this is why he's going, you know, we're looking at now two top five picks, you know, that are playing themselves into that position. Terrence Shannon was by far the most athletic dude on the court. 100% dead stop. I've never seen someone that quick. He was in the beginning when they he was first starting to get downhill. He was terrifying. And in transition, I think those were his only points. In the half court, Steph Castle had the perfect ability to give him an inch or two, give him a little cushion to not let him blow by you while still being close enough that he can contest any shot. So nothing was comfortable for him. And that 6'6 frame that you can guard guys that are 6'9 and guard guys that are 6'2 are the reason why Castle could be as high as like a 3 or 4 pick in June. So I don't think we realize that, like, when you have that dude on the perimeter, then Donovan Klingon inside, plus a lot of positionally sound defenders like Caravan and Newton and Spencer. I mean, Spencer battled Damask when he got complete defensive masterclass. I think that when once they started to see that they were getting stops, the offense just flowed from there. Because again, it wasn't a great shooting night. What was it? I think they shot 3 of 17 from three, and one of those was Hassan Diarra in the first half, who also needs some flowers here in a little bit. But again, it's you walk out like, how did that happen? And give Charles Barkley credit. You know, he's not the most like renowned ball knower, but he said, like, you know, what was crazy about that run is it was happening. Well, it wasn't that they were raining threes or were full court pressing and getting turnovers and easy layups. It was go down the court, stop, bucket, go down the court, stop, bucket, go down the court, stop, bucket. And to string together all those stops, I have the play-by-play, and I almost want to like write like a deep dive long form article about that, because that just isn't normal. I mean, that hasn't happened in 2 years. And then to have it be an Elite Eight game against the number 2 offense in the country. Just absolutely absurd. And the appreciation that I have is I think UConn fans get it. They are all aboard. My dad said that he's a lawyer. He said at the end of his case, the judge goes, go Huskies. The judge, Mr. Buttoned Up, you know, is saying go Huskies. The whole state is behind this team. And it's so great to see. I'm probably not saying anything new, but when I flew in, I asked my dad, I'm like, are they getting behind this? Because this is pretty insane. And he goes, oh, yeah. You know, the people are loving it.
Yeah, I feel like just anecdotally, I've gotten more texts, comments from people just saying like, wow, like this team looks incredible. People that I, work with or talk to like tangentially, everyone's hitting me up and just saying like, wow, what an incredible team. And it's true. The 30 to nothing run, for folks that aren't familiar, I feel like we need to get into it now, Patrick. But Evan Maia has a metric called a kill shot. So it's basically any 10 nothing run is considered a kill shot. And those are very, very beneficial to winning games. So just to gloss over it, to Evan Maia's knowledge, it was the first triple kill shot in any Division One men's game in over 3 years. It was UConn's longest run since like 1992 in, I guess it's Big East, but against New Hampshire, 32-0 in the non-conference season. It was truly insane. And the thing that I keep coming back to is, you could see, UConn came out strong out of the gates to start that second half. It's 10-0, 8-0, 12-0. You could see Illinois start to panic on offense as the snowball was rolling downhill and getting bigger. You could see, I think it was Coleman Hawkins had like a desperation three-pointer 7 seconds into the shot clock from like 5 feet behind the line, back rim. Like they were absolutely panicking. They were looking for anything to stop the bleeding. And I think it helps that UConn has just been there. They've just done this already. This is old hat. Like there's new faces, but it's the same coaching staff, a lot of the same players. They know how to handle themselves in these Elite Eight games, these Sweet 16 games that really, really matter. When the going gets tough, they're digging in instead of panicking and running around like a chicken with their head cut off. And it was so jarring to see how calm UConn looked, even throughout the first half when things weren't really going right, and how frantic Illinois was. Basically, as soon as UConn ripped off that like 7-0, 8-0 start to the second half, it was so jarring. And I mean, given the circumstances, I've seen a lot of incredible runs when I was covering the women's team. This year's team is nothing different. Given the context of everything, I don't know if I've ever seen a more impressive performance. It's just Illinois is an incredibly good team. They almost won 30 games, really good in the Big Ten, Big Ten tournament champion. This is not a slouch. They're not playing Georgetown. They're not playing DePaul. This is a real basketball team that is really talented, albeit flawed. And you can't just beat the brakes off of them in the final 20 minutes, like they've really done all year.
Think back to last year when they had a similar blowout of Arkansas or even Gonzaga. Let's be honest, those two teams quit. They just packed their shit in and said, "All right, we're done." Illinois didn't do that. They did not quit in that second half during that run. They kept trying to run different things. And in fact, even Underwood was like going deep into his bench. I saw when he threw out like Hansberry. The game was not over yet. There was still 13 minutes left. It's like he's trying different shit. There was just no answer. And I will give Illinois fans credit. They represented well. It was probably 60-40 UConn, maybe 70-30, but that 40 or 30% was loud in the first half. And you hit the nail on the head. When they tied it up with 1:49 left in the first in this first half, they lost their shit. Oh my God, like we're tied. And meanwhile, Hassan Diarra comes down, hits a three, two free throws, second half, first half. And the team just they didn't blink at all. Because and what I found interesting is that like what UConn had relied on with San Diego State was like this insane offensive rebounding. They weren't getting that. They were losing the rebounding margin in the first half. They were losing the fast break points. All the things that they had previously demolished teams with was pretty even. And that was the story that I had typed out was like interesting. Like, Illinois found a way to negate this insane offensive rebounding team that UConn has. And they go out in the second half and don't rely on offensive rebounding. They just rely on good old fashioned, like stop inside to the tall guy, bucket score. It was like, it was travel basketball almost essentially. Like, okay, throw it into him. I'm simplifying it a lot, but that really was what it was. Beat you down the court. Okay. It was, yeah, go ahead.
We have to talk about Frank Underwood as well. I think the NCAA tournament is very, very hard when you're in these weekends where you have one day to prep for a team. I thought Frank Underwood honestly said all the right things. Trying, like, UConn is a juggernaut. He said they're running a lot of stuff that we have seen before. We think we'll be prepared. I haven't, you know, I don't know much about them right now. He's trying to take it one game at a time. I feel like he said all the right things. He maybe was a little brash about it, though. He did really gloss over. He's like, you know, we can handle it. They have the big guy. We've seen some big guys. And him coming into the postgame presser after that game and being like, I didn't expect that. That was crazy. Is one of the funniest moments. I know we talked about, I think we brought up, maybe it was before we started recording, Patrick, but Larry David was there. And it feels like a, like, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Seinfeld skit playing out in real time, because it's just immediate justification. Like, everything just comes crashing down at once, because I think Underwood is, I think he's a really good coach personally. I think this is just a really tough matchup. I wonder if Illinois had a whole week to prepare. I would like to think that it's probably a different story, but that's tournament basketball, right? I think that's the thing that Dan Hurley is stressed too. Why they, when they play these MTE events early in November, you have to prepare to play in the tournament. It's a different beast than going on the road and playing a Marquette team and then coming home and playing Xavier. There's so many different factors between travel, preparation, film, everything that goes into it. UConn and the coaching staff is just doing an incredible job at nailing those things right now. And by the way, they also have five of the 15 best players left in the tournament. So everything is kind of coming together. They're going to be a force in Phoenix. They're going to take on an Alabama team that's really good. And honestly, probably the only analytically inclined team that UConn has really faced, other than like Marquette. I guess Marquette's kind of up there too, but they're the only team that I think can fight fire with fire. So we can talk about that later. But Patrick, you did make one point. I wanted to bring this up. We have to give Hassan Diarra his flowers. 11 points, just a walking bucket the second he comes in the court, just absolutely locked up Damask. Any guard that Illinois had that was bringing the ball up, he's just in their front pocket the entire time. And he's just so relentless and tenacious. And I watch a lot of games with my wife, and we just joke that there's one game, one part of every game that Hassan Diarra just takes the ball from someone. Sometimes it's not even like an obvious steal. He just goes and gets it, and it's a layup. It's a three-pointer, and he just killed so many of those Illini rallies. Like you said, that three when things got tied up kind of put, not the dagger, but it kind of softened the blow of getting things back to even close to halftime. I feel like if Illinois goes into the locker room tied up, there's a lot of momentum with that. Like, you could really build off of that. And Hassan Diarra just said, no, I'm not really feeling that today. I'm going to stop right here. And just really cool to see that after the march that he had last year, and for him to be able to be such a big part of this team going to the Final Four now.
It was really cool to see him and Mamadou have some moments after the game, embracing. And it's so glad to see. Like, this is a dude who never lacked confidence, but, like, you can finally see, like, everyone else views him the same way that, like, he has viewed him now. And it's, like, that's rewarding, I think, to him. That, like, people find, like, oh, they finally get what I bring. It took a while for some, not for you and me. We were stockholders for a long, long time. Essentially, I remember I wanted him to come here before he went to A&M. I was like, this dude looks perfect for what Hurley's trying to do. But there were some people that, like, that are more, I think, analytically inclined, that didn't like the shooting numbers and didn't like, you know, the turnovers, that saw, you know, the negatives. But it took a year to smooth over all of those negatives and now accentuate the positives, where every shot that he puts up, like, okay, cool, I'm fine with that. I think he might have had one that was just like, all right, Hassan, let's relax. But, like, fine, like, that's, you want an irrational confidence guy. I know I sound like Bill Simmons right now, but, like, you want that dude coming off the bench and setting the tone. He is, it's such a luxury to have a guy to come off and be like, all right, let's go, new look. Let's see what Hassan can give him. And to see how technical he is with his leverage as a defender up close, he's not just like, and again, people need to realize, not, I know this sounds like super privileged to have, like, been up close to that, but, like, it's not just being a, like, big athletic dude. You have to be smart with how you move your body, with how you take different angles. And there's so much nuance to that He's not just like some dude that's out there that's like more athletic than everybody. He's thinking out there. He's, Hurley is telling him where to check different people. And that kind of gets into another point that I have noticing up close. God, this coaching staff is incredible. Luke Murray, Kamani Young, Tom Moore, even the managers, Luke Murray is essentially coaching that game on his own. It's almost like Hurley runs the timeouts and kind of oversees things, but Luke and Kamani are just as vocal, each with their own little tasks, calling things out. There's no pretense between the three of them. Like you see them kind of give each other like random looks every now and then. I saw one time, I think Samson Johnson had a great game, by the way, with his vertical lob threat. But early on, Illinois had kind of fought their way back into the game when Donovan Clingan came out because they were trying to keep that first foul at one foul. And you saw Hurley and Luke just kind of like very like, what do you think now? Like Donovan now? And you don't see that level of rapport with many coaching staffs. That, this is a coaching staff that has been through, championships, the lows, and they are in complete control of what they do. And Luke Murray was the crazier one out there. I swear, I've got video of him just, fist pumping and doing the shit that Hurley does. And as my dad pointed out, when he was the assistant at Fairfield, he just sat in the corner quietly. It's like Hurley, gave him, not confidence, but like, breathed some life and fire into him. Not that he didn't have it before, but he's like, hey, it's okay to act like this. You don't have to be sitting there with your clipboard whispering to me. You can be out here yelling in yourself. And it's a such a positive, engaging environment. When you factor in all of like the fact that then they're also insane at basketball is incredible.
Yeah, I think something that always stuck with me from the title run last year, I think Hurley said it right after they won, or maybe they were in Hartford at the parade or whatever. But he said, most teams have one or two NBA players. My team had three. So it's my job to get them to the Final Four and to win the championship. Like the talent wasn't the issue. Like it's really just me. And I keep thinking about that because I feel like we're already in a similar spot. Right. Castle is an NBA guy. Klingon is an NBA guy. Those are top five guys. And you can say, we'll call Caravan Spencer, Tristan Newton, I think deserves some recognition as well. Those are NBA caliber players, right? But then you throw in this coaching staff. I don't think anyone in the country would disagree that Kamani Young and Luke Murray could coach just about anywhere they wanted to, if the money was right, if the fit was right, if they wanted to leave UConn, which I saw some tweets about that, some rumblings about that, about why they like to stay. But everything's just coming together. Like they probably have the best coaching staff in the country. I think that's very fair to say. And they probably have the best roster of any of the, we're recording this on Sunday here, any of the what, six teams left in the tournament. They probably have the best NBA talent roster. So it makes sense, right? Like things are just coming together, but it's so hard to do this in the NCAA tournament. They've won 10 games by double digits in the NCAA tournament. It's a new record. This is not supposed to happen. This is not stuff that's normal. And I think it speaks to the coaching staff and the influx of new players that came in this year, the Cam Spencers, even Hassan Diarra wasn't a new player, but in a very different role. If you look at the sideline during the games, when they're going to the Final Four, they're winning the Elite Eight, Sweet 16 matchups, they're acting like they've been there before, but they're reacting like they're doing this for the first time. Like they are not thinking about last year at all. And I think the coaching staff has done such a good job about channeling the mindset of this team towards just focusing on the next game and not focusing on the outside pressure, the conversations going on outside about like, is this the most dominant basketball team in recent men's history? Like it's just such an impressive coaching job. And personally, as a UConn fan, this Final Four win means so much because I do really think that UConn has the horses to cut down the nets next weekend in Phoenix. But if they don't, they could very well get beat. Like stuff like that happens. This Final Four win cements this Final Four appearance cements this team as one of the greats. And if they do it all, they're probably the greatest UConn team ever. But if not, they're 100% in that conversation. Most wins in program history, back-to-back Final Fours, total dominance in the Big East, in the Big East tournament. It's just been so impressive to see this ride, and I'm happy that there's going to be, no matter what happens in Phoenix, there's going to be some recognition on the walls of Campbell for what this team's accomplished.
You make a good point about how excited everybody is. I almost thought that weirdly, kind of more of an indictment on how my brain works, but like they were so excited and so jacked up and celebrating. I was almost in my head, and I saw, and I think it was Steph Castle's dad, saying to the crowd, like, two more, two more. And it brought me back almost to like, oh shit, yeah, they're not done yet. And I, lingering kind of like constant pessimism in me is like, oh shit, like, are they celebrating too much? Like, and then I kind of like thought about it as I was like going to sleep, like, no, because this is, like you said, an entirely new team. Even Samson and Hassan, they were Andrew Hurley's buddies at that point on the end of the bench last year. So it was really only Donovan Clingan, Caravan, and Tristan Newton. But even as Tristan Newton said, he was like the sixth option on the team last year. Alex Caravan just had to hit a couple of threes. Donovan Clingan was just there to, be the game change or the tempo changer. Not saying that that was all he was, but that was his role at that point. So they should be celebrating this, and it goes back to the level of energy Hurley has created. It's not some kind of like fake machismo. I'm only going to do it in the highs. It is a nonstop, like steady, like heart rate increasing type of thing that it allows you, like there's just joy around the team. I heard it in the locker room as I'm walking by. First of all, the one knock I will say is they did the stupid "I believe that we will win" chant from soccer, which I hate, but whatever. I'm not going to sit here and Euro snob the UConn men's basketball team, but there's just an infectious joy that this team has. I loved Caravan's quote after the game of like, it takes a, I need to find it. It takes a lot of sickos to what to do we do to do what we're doing, but there's not a single no oh, what we're doing is not normal, but there's no normal people in this locker room. Having been around that locker room, I can agree. There's just something different. Everyone, there's no egos. Now, who knows if that's Hurley has stamped out egos or he's brought in people that just fit that. But and I know, winnings makes everything easier. But I even think that this is a team that when there's going through adversity, there's no finger pointing. There's no, I need to speak my mind or I have something to say. There's not enough words need to be said about that. And it's just so crazy to like when we fire up the pod, like, oh, this is amazing. This is awesome. It's like all this gushing that we're doing, it's not hyperbole. This isn't like, oh, this is a really good Final Four team that we have. Like, this is a potentially historic, going down in history as not just the best UConn team, but as, excuse me, one of the best NCAA teams ever, if things continue to trend that way. And I do agree with what you said that the Final Four does validate a lot of things, regardless of what happens. Alabama's really good. And like you said, efficiency-wise, they are going to give UConn some problems on the offensive end, I think. Meaning that, like, they have shot-making guards that are quick and get to the rim, but they also, threes and layups. So if it's, if we can shut off the paint a little bit, maybe, they can stop the threes. But again, I think would they shoot 60% from three against Clemson, and they fire them up. I think they had 37 attempts or something absurd. So even if they stumble and there's some random game, because college sports is littered with unstoppable teams. Think of Kentucky in 24 or 2015, the 40-0 team, and some really good Wisconsin team with dipshit Frank Kaminsky comes out and ruins that destiny. Like that is around the corner, but given the body of work in the last year, it should still be celebrated, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do want to dive in on this Bama team a little bit. And I know we'll have more preview content, more in-depth analysis throughout the week between Store Central, the UConn blog, Fast Break, anywhere you can find us. But this is, it's honestly very similar to Illinois. I would say just looking at the KenPom stats and how things shake out, the thing that sticks out to me is that they're ninth in tempo and over 46% of their field goal attempts are three-pointers. And when you factor in that they're a very analytically inclined team, like that shot chart is going around on Twitter. I'm sure we'll address it at some point, you know, in a blog or whatever, but it's all threes and it's all layups. And that's exactly the type of basketball that it's going to take to beat a team like UConn. And somehow San Diego State, Illinois, you know, probably didn't figure that out, but it seems like Nate Oates kind of has the formula to do what it takes to take down a team like UConn. But the defense is pretty rough. They're 104th in defensive efficiency. That is worse than Illinois. It's one of the worst that UConn has gone up against all year, honestly. And the offense is quite good. It's behind Illinois, behind UConn, and it's third in offensive efficiency. So it's a good team. There's some really quality players. Mark Sears, standout guard, 6'1", over 43% from three. And Grant Nelson, I believe it was Grant Nelson, had one of the more impressive plays I've seen. It was in the Elite Eight game. He missed two free throws to go up and basically put the game away. And instead of panicking, caught the rebound or
Sweet
guarded
16.
Sweet 16. Yeah.
Blocked the shot.
Just stood up, full arms up like a wall, like Donovan Clingan, and just blocked the half court shot. And, you know, that was the end of that. So I think it speaks to the type of players that Nate Oates has. Like, these are really smart, cerebral players, really well in the run the offense really well. The defense is going to be a wild ride, but they had the hardest schedule in the country per KenPom. I'm just looking through right now. And there's some crazy wins and losses. Like, they lost to Florida by 14. They beat North Carolina by 2. Earlier in the year, they lost to Purdue. They lost to Creighton. They lost to Arizona. They're playing really good basketball as of now, but, you know, Nate Oates is going to have a week to prep for UConn. Dan Hurley will have a week to prep for Alabama. So it'll be interesting. Patrick, what are your thoughts?
I think a team that UConn will, I don't think they have the defensive firepower to truly beat UConn. I think they are going to give UConn a heart attack on the offensive end for sure. There's going to be some, if not many, defensive breakdowns because of the shot making abilities that team has. And the Pringle dude inside is a load next to Nelson that worries me with Caravan. But I just don't think they have the defensive chops to do it. The team that beats UConn is someone that disrupts their ball movement and forces Tristan Newton into hero mode, or forces Cam Spencer into shot-making mode as opposed to running their offense. And I don't see Alabama shutting off UConn sets. You know, Mark Sears is a killer, but he's 6'1". Throw him into every little screen possible and let Tristan Newton win that matchup. Aaron Estrada, I think, is only 6'2". I make that deal every single time. So it's going to be a little more tilted towards what everyone was expecting with the UConn-Illinois game. I just think instead of a Coleman Hawkins, who I thought really disappointed, if anything, Coleman Hawkins' performance, not to pile on the poor kid, but like lost Illinois that game, I'd say, between him and Terrence Shannon, because he got absolutely abused by Clingan inside. I think Grant Nelson and Pringle are going to give Clingan more fits offense or on defense because of the spacing. And I think Nate Oates is the kind of coach that isn't going to say, oh, we're in the Big Ten, we're just going to go at Donovan Clingan and get him in foul trouble. You know, we can handle Zach Edey, we can handle Donovan Clingan. Nate Oates is going to say, all right, Donovan Clingan, come out and guard Grant Nelson. That scares the shit out of me. So, and what I have an appreciation for with Oates is he's a constant adjuster on the fly. He has, like, you know, the modern offense down, but he last year that team had a bunch of lottery picks, some high profile transfers, and they were, you know, all these kind of like highly regarded studs. This year he stocked that team with like mid-major dudes who were outperforming or guys that were leveling up in that sense, like a little bit of Tristan Newton, as like, this guy's absolutely killing it at ECU. Now let's see what he can do within a mid or a high major system. And that has thrived. I think they've got guys that play better as a team as opposed to a bunch of Brandon Millers or I can't think of the other guy that went pro. But so there's going to be more of like a unit to break down as opposed to shut down Terrence Shannon, win the game.
Yeah, certainly a tough matchup. I just, Nate Oates, nothing but respect for him as a coach. He did great work at Buffalo, came over to Alabama. He's done a really good job so far last year. Last year, very weird year for the Tide due to a ton of circumstances. But prior to the start of the tournament, they were a pretty consensus championship favorite last year. And that's the nature of the tournament, right? Things don't necessarily work out the way that people plan. So I know, just looking through Twitter already, I saw someone tweet out David versus Goliath, and Alabama was David and UConn was Goliath. And I guess I don't truly disagree, but it's just really funny given the grand scheme of things that Alabama is trying to paint themselves as like the little guy, like fighting for what's right with their slingshot to try and take down Goliath. So I got a good kick out of that. But I think we'll get more into Alabama, the Crimson Tide, what they do on offense, what they do on defense throughout the rest of this week. And as we wrapped up, I know we had a little bit of a Larry David run-in, I would say. Patrick, is there any Larry David stories you want to share with us before we wrap up?
Yeah, it's a bummer Curb is ending, because I feel like this could have been like a story he draws upon for a future season. We've caught wind that Larry David was in the building early in the first half, but because we're locked in, we weren't really focused on that. We were just like, oh, cool, Larry David's around here. Sweet, maybe we bump into him later. In the same way that, you know, we just kind of bump into Bill Murray every now and then. No big deal. Like, no, seriously, like, you don't want to bother Bill Murray. Like, the last thing you want to do when you're there is like, oh, hey, Bill, big fan. He's there for his son. Like, you know, leave Bill Murray alone. But Larry David was there. It's like, oh, that's pretty cool. And as the half ended, we turned around and see he is right behind us, about 10 feet from, like, 10 feet to the left behind us. And so we both turn around, and I don't know. I just feel like his eyes were always, like, every time I turned around, he was looking at me and Amon. And we kind of like froze as the half ended, and Amon goes, is like, take a picture. I'm like, no, you take a picture. And he's like, all right, fine, I'll do it. You know, so he's like, both of us can't take a picture. Like, we can't both have our phones out. So I like turn around and kind of like shield him, and Amon takes a picture, and that's that. And we go into the media room and do our stuff. And then we're seeing on Twitter that he's heckling Dan Hurley the entire time, which, by the way, he also has earbuds in. So like, you can't like turn around and talk to him. And maybe that's why he's like louder, is because he has earbuds in. I don't know. But he's heckling Dan Hurley for his antics the entire time, which is funny, because it's like that they're Larry David-esque antics. And the 30-0 nuclear, you know, meltdown happens, and he gets up and leaves, and he's leaving, and I turn around and I go to Amon. I'm like, oh, Larry's leaving. And I had like my phone kind of like on me, and thought for a second to take a picture. It's like, no, that's pretty stupid to do like the above selfie thing. And I dropped my phone. If you're listening, you can probably hear that. And a beat writer next to me had his phone out, kind of doing what I had initially thought about. And Larry looks over in the classic Larry voice, don't do that. And the beat writer kind of was like, well, I was like, oh, no, I was just, you know, getting like a little picture. No, I don't like that. Don't do that. But because it's close quarters there, courtside, I am right on top of said beat writer. So he's looking at me as it's happening, even though my phone is on off my hand, away from my hands at this point. So everyone around me, Andy Katz, Bob Hurley, all these people are looking at me as if I upset Larry David. That's terrifying. Like, it probably the celebrity I am most terrified ever to have like thought about speaking to would be Larry David, because you don't know if he's going to roast you, if he's going to be incredibly warm. How is he going to, like, if you make a little joke, is he going to react to it well? And I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean that in the most legendary status ever of, like, he's so unique that, like, you're terrified to approach him. And so he walks up and leaves, and I'm sitting there, and the beat writer next to me has, like, shrunk down. And I think everyone had thought that it was me. And like you said, that's a Seinfeld skit right there. It was terrifying, but at the same time, like, insanely gratifying that, like, if that's going to be my only interaction with Larry David for the rest of my life, I'm good. Like,
you made your mark.
I made my mark. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's really all you can ask for. And it seems like he, for whatever reason, was truly hating on Dan Hurley for whatever reason, for just trying to do his job. So very interesting reaction from Larry David there. But I feel like that's a fitting way to end the East region, right? Like, UConn just running train through everything. It's so bad that the only news story that comes out of this is not about how good the team is. It's that Larry David was saying that Dan Hurley was doing too much.
Larry David rage quit. Just tossed his controller and logged off and disconnected.
Yep. Yeah. And it just goes to show that the dominance and how this UConn team looked really the whole time. So to wrap up the East region, UConn, 3 of 4 teams held to 52 points, no games, really remotely close. Cam Spencer, Steph Castle, Donovan Klingon, all named to the East, the all region East team, joined by Jaden Ledee and Terrence Shannon Jr. Klingon was named the regional's most outstanding player. The Huskies will head to a second straight Final Four to take on Alabama on Saturday at a time yet to be announced.
I mean, can't you see a Curb episode? Sorry to steal your thunder there, but, like,
no.
He's maybe coaching, like, a basketball team, and maybe that one basketball team is really good and goes on a 30-0 run, and he gets pissed, like, well, what are you doing? It's not supposed to be 30-0. Like I told you to do that. It's like, you're bad for the game. You're bad for the game.
When Curb inevitably comes back for another final season in 2 years, I think we'll see that on there.
Yeah. UConn, next Curb episode. Make it happen.
Yeah. Dan Hurley, that could be the olive branch. You know, get Dan on Curb, new market. He would be a good Curb character. He could just be himself. Yeah. He wouldn't have to be much.
You're using the call map, and then you're yelling to the refs. Like, what are you doing?
I actually just got it. It's Larry stealing Dan Hurley's dragon underwear, and that's the whole clip. That's all we need. That's 25 minutes right there.
But then not realizing that he has to, like, wash it, so he's trying to find, like, a way to wash it.
Yeah. We got it. We got it.
Larry, if you're listening. A lot of meat on that bone.
Larry, if you're listening, and I'm sure you are, feel free to come on the pod, chop it up with us next week. We could break down Alabama together. But with that being said, I think we will wrap. We will talk to you all soon. Be sure to follow us, listen in, read us at the blog, the Fast Break, Store Central, anywhere you can find us. Thank you all for listening.